Okay, everybody's coming back. So, first I wanted to ask if there are any announcements for today. Well, I have one. The GSA, that's the Geological Society of America, their abstract deadline is today. And we have a couple of climate literacy sessions there. So I've sent the email out to the listserv a number of times. I want to thank everybody who submitted abstracts for the AGU meeting, American Geophysical Union meeting last week. We got about 175 abstracts, which beats last year. Last year we had 107. So we did really well. We'll see how they get combined into how many sessions, but that was to about 12 sessions. But the 175 was out of 657 total education abstracts. Now, for those of you who don't know, the AGU meeting, it's mostly a scientist at this meeting, and last year there were over 21,000 people there. So education is a really small part of this, but we did very well abstract-wise. So, but the GSA, Geological Society of America, it's a smaller meeting. Last year there were about 8,000 people there. And we have two climate literacy sessions. So for those of you who may be contemplating getting abstracts in, today is the deadline. Any other announcements? Okay, well, if not, we will move on to our discussion for today. And just to recap, to remind everybody, last week we started this discussion about developing media messaging for effective engagement of the public in climate change. And the two pieces that this is in the Google Docs, but I just wanted to sort of reiterate that the things we were talking around last time was addressing. There was two pieces that people thought would be good starting points. Was the Yale Forum on Climate Change Messaging, which had five pieces to it. One was it's real and it's happening. Two was it is us. Three is there are serious implications for humans and ecosystems. Four was most scientists agree. And five is viable solutions exist and can be implemented. And then the other piece that was thought to be useful was the key findings from the U.S. Global Change Research Program. There's 10 key findings. The ones that were the main focus of our conversation last week was number one, global warming is unequivocal and primarily human-induced. And the 10th one, future climate change and its impacts depend on choices made today. The ones in between were ranged in specific kinds of impacts that it might have. And we went through and identified which of the Yale Forum messaging matched with which of the key findings. Then the discussion evolved to how to pose this, and the conversation moved to identifying ways in which to make these kinds of messages relevant to individuals you are trying to engage. So, the overarching umbrella was human well-being or human health, where the sub-issues might be issues around water, food, energy, and extreme weather and sea level rise. That's kind of a summary of the content of the conversation last week, just to bring everybody else who wasn't part of that conversation a little bit up to date. Again, it's in the Google, all of this is in the Google Docs that I posted the link to. And then I posted this yesterday, and it elicited tremendous discussion, which was really quite interesting, that we can build on today. And my take from the first set of email exchanges was to think about addressing, to not overstep what the science says, but to use current extremes in weather during specific seasons, such as this summer, as an example of things to come. And that was the main my main take from the detailed conversations from the email. So with that, I want to open it up to everybody else who might have a comment on how we might move forward with this in either developing the messaging or identifying ways in which the Climate Literacy Network can best move forward to engage people in this more effectively. So are there any thoughts out there?
Well, I have thoughts, but this is Don. I've been on the road and I haven't kept up on the email exchange. I did read the Google Doc. And one thought that I have is that energy is, our use of energy is the driver of all of this, because energy makes everything else that we as a society do happen. And that's not very clear from looking at the Google Doc. I'm wondering if we should make it more clear, I guess, is my question.
Yeah, well, we didn't get to that kind of level. I think that if you're looking at the Google Doc now, the section where it's in all capital letters, human well-being, and then the items underneath it, my thought last time was we were talking in terms, and I'm not saying this is the best way to go, but in terms of these public service announcements, and it was a thought that, you know, public service announcements really short, but that each one might focus on a particular one of these topics, and energy is one of them, and that they'd be able to stand by themselves but also interrelate with each other. Mm-hmm. But I would think that for any one of these topics, it would elicit a detailed conversation with experts in developing engaging messaging, and also accurate science and, well, the social science aspects too, the economics of it all. So I agree that, but we didn't get to the point of delving in deeply into any one of these particular avenues.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anyone on the phone who was engaged in the email exchange that might want to clarify their take on the content of the email exchange?
Yeah, this is Paul Vincelli. I'm pretty new to all this, at least the teleconference. I haven't been part, and I don't have the sort of the institutional history, but I was involved in the email exchanges, last night and today, I guess. Is that what you're referring to?
Absolutely. That's exactly what I'm referring to.
Yeah. I think you've hit on those. There was sort of a discussion that really centered around, there were probably several themes, but really one was, how do we talk about, weather extremes in a way that's, faithful to the science, meaningful to people. So that was a big part of what was being discussed. In fact, just a few minutes before the phone call, I put out for those that care to read and react a short draft of an extension publication I'm putting together that uses metaphors to, and I think it's scientifically accurate, but, we'll see what kind of feedback I get. So that was the whole theme of what I was gathering from the discussions today. And it seems Go ahead.
No, that's fine. As I was reading, I think that it's always been very difficult to walking that line between climate changes are based on large scale processes and long time averages, and then on the other hand, those are the issues that can affect weather down the line. but then how do you make that relevant to individuals in terms of their day-to-day lives that is true to the science?
Yeah.
It is true to the statistics, and just not everybody really understands what statistical averages are and what variability is. I mean, the difference between natural variability, the weather on December 15th this year isn't going to be the same as it was last year. It can vary wildly, and that's very different from climate. And I actually think that it needs to be an integral part of what high school students learn, what the difference is, whether it's applied to climate or any situation, the statistics. But in what we've been talking about in terms of engaging the public, figuring out how to do that in a way, and I think of one of the early comments in that email exchange was to not really talk about who caused it or why it's happening, because that gets away from having to deal with it if you start having the argument about who caused it or how it was caused or whether it's real. I mean, it really kind of doesn't matter whether it's naturally caused or man-made, if you have to deal with the flooding now. It may, I mean, if you want to do something longer term to either slow those kinds of changes or if it's possible to reverse them, that's another story. Then you have to address the causes. But in terms of addressing and adapting to the situation now, it doesn't really matter how it was caused.
Mm.
So,
yeah.
But wouldn't you want to just not have it continue being caused? I mean, isn't that?
Yeah.
That's true. You don't. You want to not have it to continue being caused. But there's two pieces to that.
Mm-hmm.
There's one is not having it continue being caused, but people are going to have to adapt anyway to some degree.
I have a big problem with. While I believe adaptation is front and center, what we all have to think about and do, mitigation cannot be off the table. And when you don't address the causes, you take mitigation off the table. And I think that's what I'm hearing here.
Right.
And what I've been sort of insisting on with the informal science centers that want to take the, who cares who's causing it? We have to deal with it.
I agree. This is Carol Mandrick, and I haven't been on here for a while, and I don't recognize everybody's voices. And so I just want to say the person who was saying it doesn't matter who causes it, I am so happy to hear you say that, because that's what I've been saying for over a year. And this doesn't mean don't mitigate, and it doesn't mean don't talk to the people who could get these kind of things. It means there are people who are going to be shut down and not be part of the conversation to catch them up and who causes it. And the bottom line is we want to change behavior.
Yeah, this is Paul Vincelli again. I think that might have been that comment, if I understood it correctly, might have been what Andy Revkin said. And I think it was a really good point. I'm definitely of the mindset of we must mitigate and we must mitigate now. I mean, it's really frustrating for me to hear people talk about adaptation. But on the other hand, there might be wisdom in that, because I think what his point was, and what I've heard others say is that getting the public to understand the need for adaptation creates a sort of a gateway into which eventual the recognition of the need to mitigate happens.
Yeah.
Do you think that do you think that the messages can be separated so that I think you're right, that I think once you get people to take the step to adapt, then they can become more into the mindset of thinking about how to mitigate.
Because they don't want to have to adapt as much. Hopefully. You see the real cost. Yeah.
Well, it's a means to an end. I mean, I hear everybody and what you're saying. I just kind of feel a little bit selling out on the science. But that, I understand it's a means to an end.
Well, what I'm thinking, Caroline, is that they don't in the messages that we develop, they don't have to be we don't have to just drop mitigation off. It's just that it may be a progression, sort of like parallel to what we talk about in the education world of learning progressions.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking about what it is, you know, what are the issues now that I have to adapt to? And once you get into that enough to understand the issues, then you're more open to thinking about mitigating. And, you know, as we think about the Six Americas spectrum, obviously those that are on the more alarmed side and concerned side will be ready for the mitigation messages earlier than the others. So I think that they should be developed simultaneously.
Right, and I don't think
the audience that they're presented to might vary.
Exactly. We shouldn't drop anything off. We should be crafting all these messages for all these different audiences.
So the whole discussion started because some of us felt the need for concrete talking points or messaging coming from authoritative national figures. And it really isn't just about a TV ad running on NBC versus Fox. It's about airports and train stations and buses and, you know, PSAs going up about climate science and the facts of it's happening, it's us, it's consensus. And I think that sort of grounds the readiness level of the two, I call it the left-hand side of the Six Americas. They're in my ballpark. I can work with the disengaged. I don't go after deniers, but, you know, I think the two-thirds, the left-hand part of the Six Americas, would feel more ready to sort of embrace adaptation and stuff when a national message is, yep. And,
okay. This is Marta. I mean, looking at the climate change messaging situation, I mean, I think all of those things are good. What I would want to have added is just, and here's what we can do, or here are five things what you can do, or because it's, you know, we talk about where I am, we talk about the four D's of climate change. I might have said this on this forum at one point, but, you know, the first one is denial, it's not happening. The second one is despair, it's happening, there's nothing we can do about it. The third one is delinquency, it's happening, there's nothing I can do about it, let's party, let's get a Humvee. And the fourth is delight or desire, and that is that it's happening, there is something we can do about it, and that the new world might actually be better than the old one, so let's get going. And so I sort of feel like what I think if we can grab a hold of some things that will help to make people feel empowered, I think that we will see that shift.
Well, I think that last week one of the things we discussed was how to include that piece. And my thought on that was that if these messages are of high enough level, overarching level, at which then we can point, because we can't make them local for everybody. It's just not possible. But if we include an element by which those that are using the messages for a particular audience can point to where the local efforts that are ongoing that people can engage in, that kind of ties together these broader messages with local action for what people can do.
Right.
And so that was what I was hoping we would be able to, because I also see the line, the tension between those two things. Making it locally relevant means pointing to what people can do. Most people really can't address things at a global scale.
Well, that's part of the reason that I brought up the making the energy issue more prominent, mm-hmm. is because everybody uses energy and can think about how to use less and how to how to engage others in using less.
And everybody uses.
But I would think that even in from one region to the other, the modes of using energy are different,
and that's true.
Why local use of energy from your region to Nevada is this what you can do to decrease your energy use may be very different. And that's,
mm-hmm.
so I agree that that energy is a way that we can see how everybody can be engaged, and that's why having a large-scale overarching message around energy, or maybe multiple, I would guess that it would probably be more useful to have multiple messages about energy that are broad scale, but mm-hmm. then to allow there to be a connection to that the local things you can do that are most effective in wherever you are.
I think that would be great. This is Marta. I think it's interesting that in the list under human well-being and human health, air is missing, which might be helpful.
Well, I think Tamara is summarizing it nicely. It's big picture messages and links to, like, the last thing is, like, what we do matters. Find out more. Visit miamidade.gov or whatever our local links are is the way to do it. But to keep the big messaging on the big picture ideas and the big picture facts that then make people want to say, okay, what could I do? What is my role? How am I, what is my community doing, you know? Well, you know, the problem and while I love the philosophical, how to treat the weather incidents and be true to the science, and it really helps frame my thinking in right ways, I believe, I do think we're getting away from the idea of these talking points and who is the national voice of it. And so the first big picture question is, does CLN want to take this on, Tamara? And, you know, as sort of the leader, the leaders of CLN need to think, okay, are we looking at pushing for a national platform? Are we looking at just kind of working quietly on some good big picture talking points, or what are we doing? Are we just having a good time, setting some thoughts? I mean, I'm having a good time. It's just that my intention is a little selfish. Is I want people to be engaged and to see themselves in a solution and all of that, but I want them to know it's bigger than us. And when I say, and this is how it started a couple of weeks ago, I said, when I get up and I say things like 97.4% of published scientists believe it's anthropogenic, that the National Academies of Science, about every developed country in the world, agrees, there is consent. And they go, why don't I know this? And then they start writing down those phrases. Mm-hmm. You mean the National Academies of Science in every developed country in the world agrees it's AGW? It means that there are solutions in the pipeline that we could jump on now? You mean, and so that was a sort of, selfishly, I was looking at what sort of national umbrella, because they're not reading what you and I are reading. They're not listening to unbiased TV and radio stations. So where do we get them with information in an unbiased setting would be planes, trains, and automobiles, so airports and train stations and buses. And this is where I see this messaging nationally, this message brought to you by powerful groups and the National Institutes of Health. And when you start listing that, people are going, wow. So that Clio Project thing that I heard about, maybe I should look at that. So it's more about a big message from the big guys, the big guns nationally, to say, yeah, this is real and what we do does matter. Find out what your community is doing, you know?
So
go ahead.
Yeah, this is Mark, and I really hear what you're saying, and I think my concern as somebody who has been involved with the Climate Literacy Network since day one is that when we formed, our core mission was to support climate education, and I think by extension, because we were also involved with developing the energy literacy framework, energy education, whether or not people are paying attention, there's literally hundreds of groups out there that are pushing for people to support climate awareness, climate policy, and people pay attention or they don't. I think that my concern is that by sinking a lot of time and energy into trying to craft these messages, that we distract from the fact that in the education arena, climate change is often missing altogether. It's when it is taught, it's skimmed over or it's taught as controversy. And, you know, we're not just focused on formal education in classrooms, but that's where I think Climate Literacy Network's real strength and kind of our ecological niche is. I'm not against exploring messaging, but there's so many groups that are already doing that, and maybe people involved with CLN that want to get involved with some of those other groups should join those other groups too. But the need for making sure that climate change is well taught, that it's integrated with energy throughout the curriculum, is enormous. And frankly, you know, my own personal opinion is that we can distract from pushing for good climate education if we get too caught up in trying to develop PSAs and messaging, which I don't frankly think we have the expertise to deal with. Our strength is in education.
Well, Mark, Mark, this is Tamara. I think that the Climate Literacies Network while we're very focused on education, I sort of see it as education in a much broader sense, and that each of us is involved in a different piece of this and is using what everybody else brings to the table to leverage our efforts. And so what I thought that Caroline was asking for is consistent messages, so that I wasn't really looking that the Climate Literacy Network would disseminate this in billboards and public service announcements, but if we developed a consistent message where CLIO could move ahead with doing it and you, Mark, with NCSE could use the same messages that within your programs, not necessarily in the same way, but that they just are consistent in that way, because I agree there's lots of groups already doing this, but it's just so that there's something that the Climate Literacy Network could help bring about all of its members being able to convey using similar language, consistent messages that have been talked through and focus on things that are relevant. So
yeah.
I was thinking this is more of an effort that we might not make the Climate Literacy Network might not put together a proposal to do public service announcements, but if we can develop the core of a set of messages, and then maybe some set of us would, in their own region, puts together a proposal that they can get funded to use them, then that's to the benefit of everybody. Mm-hmm. But
I see that this is something that
everybody could leverage.
I really don't disagree. But again, there's such a need in the educational arena to make sure that climate change is there, and it's by and large missing.
All right, I need a point of clarification here. This is Caroline, and I kind of feel responsible for co-launching this whole thing, so it's kind of fun. But Tamara has taken it in a different direction, one that I can easily support, but it wasn't the original intent. And the original intent was not, from my point of view, was not to create the messages, but to ask a national body to send some national messages out to all of us. So it wasn't about the CLN being the writer of messages.
Mm-hmm.
It is about the CLN proposing that common messages be formed and spread across our nation. So I think the conversation is so healthy because Mark is right. I mean, the K-12 curriculum, the K-16 curriculum, is in trouble. But then on the other hand, Mark, efforts like this can only heighten the receptivity for more K-16 curriculum and integration and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's an interesting discussion, and I think it's time for us to start thinking, okay, CLN, do we want to be more than just curriculum resource peer-reviewed robust creation stuff? Do we want to also say some basic science consensus needs to be publicly communicated. Do we want to be a voice that even asks the NIH to take this on? I don't think the answer is yes. I'm just asking, where would it come from if somebody like me wanted to approach the EPA or somebody to say, why aren't we on a national campaign to get some of these sound bites out? Where would I start? Would it be Caroline from CLIO doing this? Would it be Caroline as CLIO and part of CLN? Would CLN want to be a common voice that says, you know what, folks, we're doing great things. We're building the curriculum resources and putting them in the laps of teachers and kids. What could you do for us now? And who would I speak to about this? So, Mark, it was much more about that than crafting.
Well, I think, Caroline, part of the problem with going to federal agencies like federal organizations like the National Institutes of Health or EPA is that they're federally funded and they can't make suggestions about how they can't advocate, and it's a really fine line. And
what is advocating?
What
is a fact? Are you advocating fact? Is advocacy? In other words, the National Academy.
If we want to suggest what people should do, that's advocating.
Well, then let's not. Let's just say the message is be informed, the public. This is real. We're causing it. And there's consensus. And what we do matters. Find out more. Visit whatever.com. I'm really into having the people that I love who are not reading the newspaper and watching the TV unbiasedly getting a national message. Where are they getting it? Who's getting it? We're all in our silos being fed stuff based on our previous Google search history. So that's kind of the mystery to me about, and I think, Mark, I think you said hundreds of efforts. I think there's thousands of efforts on the ground, tens of thousands, and every one of them is good to great. And I believe there's no one magic bullet. There are many, many magic bullets, so we fire away in our own ways, with our own beliefs and target audiences. So I was really coming at this more of a pie in the sky, maybe, but, you know, why not put it out there?
Okay, so does anybody else who's on the call have any thoughts about either the direction that the Climate Literacy Network should take, or for the particular messages that we might want to put together?
You know, it's Mark again, and I know earlier there was some discussion about adaptation, mitigation, and so forth. Some of you know Stephanie Furman, who's from Barnard College, and she's associated with the Lamont Doty Research Facility up there at Columbia. And they've been teaching a class on climate change for over 20 years for undergraduates. And recently they added adaptation to the mix. And oftentimes before, they would tack on adaptation towards the tail end. And this past year, she had adaptation up front, and that was partly at the suggestion of students. And she found that the students really got engaged in a way that she had never seen before, because they felt really empowered. She had them do essentially a role-playing game, looking at Arctic resources and the melting of sea ice and ice caps and so forth, and how that is impacting the Arctic. And, you know, there was a part of it that was about mitigation, but, you know, a lot of it was just dealing with the fact that the changes are already happening and will continue to happen for decades to come, you know, even if we stopped burning fossil fuels today. You know, rather than having the students overwhelmed by sort of the gloom and doom of all that, they felt really empowered to learn that there are things to do, and there's a lot of different perspectives that we have to understand. So it was kind of taking the science but applying it in a societal and environmental context.
And Mark, did she really focus on adaptation, or was there a component around mitigation?
Well, yeah, there was a component of mitigation, but it was more like guess what, the sea ice is melting, and what are we going to do to prepare for it? You know, because we can't magically stop it tomorrow, even if we had a cap-and-trade policy in place yesterday. You know, so much of the changes that we're seeing have a momentum that will last for decades, if not longer, you know. And, you know, rather than avoiding adaptation, we need to really recognize that's really where the action is these days. You know, in Colorado, a lot of communities are developing drought and wildfire mitigation plans, which are effectively climate change adaptation plans in many respects. That's where they're putting the energy, because the changes are happening whether they like it, you know, whether we acknowledge or like it or not.
Well, adaptation lends itself, well, so does mitigation, but to this solution-oriented approach that's so healthy and works and engages people. And so I think that there's a lot to be said for that, you know, empowering learners, students to think about, okay, how are we going to solve this? You know, what can we do? They get creative, they get, you know, empowered, and it's pretty awesome.
This is Jay in Wisconsin, and I work with, you know, University of Wisconsin Extension. And I just wanted to chime in on this adaptation thing a little bit. That's mostly as far as climate change education where I live, being in an extension there, working with adult learners, in the community organizations, local governments, and businesses. And extension in Wisconsin, our main thing is I'm currently on a committee developing curricula for our educators across our extension departments on climate change, and a lot of it, some of it, climate change science net. But I myself have come to the conclusion that the question of mitigation is not, in the first place, most importantly, a technical question. It's a question of political will, and therefore, having not been impressed with the political will of the government of the United States since I was born, I've not, you know, waiting around for them and the international community to do something. Now, I think mitigation is very important, and I just want to mention this because, first of all, adaptation is definitely the low-hanging fruit right now as far as climate change outreach. And as the weather gets weirder every year, the fruit's going to get lower and lower and start dropping on the ground. Now, I wanted to just tell, though, how I bring mitigation into adaptation myself. Mm-hmm. And the way I do that is when I'm working, I do a gig on request with our local business community. And I live in a very conservative area. And basically, it's climate change strategy for business. And the way mitigation comes in there is basically what I put it out there for, to see if people are interested in taking some training on it, is I'm just reading off the flyer right now. I'll just read it to you. Are you part of a Walmart supply chain? Do you do business with the West Coast? And do you do business internationally? Then your business should have a carbon or climate change strategy. For free, we'll teach you at your workplace in the county about the Walmart Sustainability Initiative, the Carbon Disclosure Project, Greenhouse Gas Protocol, Introduction to Climate Change Strategy. And the reason is because business will be interested in mitigation if their customers are, or if they are a supplier in a large supply chain and their customers are interested in mitigation. So I'm just saying that's not a silver bullet or anything, but that's like one way I bring mitigation into adaptation, because for a business, adapting to climate change actually includes mitigation if they fall in the right category.
Right.
Yeah.
Wanted to throw that in.
Yeah, thanks, Jay.
So when you say if they're in the right category, can you talk about that a bit more?
Yeah, sure. Basically, being I'm in the United States, the biggest thing, of course, for any business is return on investment. Everything boils down to return on investment, okay? And I find if I'm not dealing directly with anything on return on investment, anything falls on deaf ears, basically, because that's all there is what is this quarter, what is this? And, you know, that's like a simple reality I have to live with. So mitigation comes in, like I said, if their customers are interested in it, or if because of what they do for a business, a new product or service or a change in a product or service could be a new product line. I have one local business, in fact, that has started developing a new product line. Simply, it's within their area of competency, simply based on renewables and climate change and stuff like that. The other thing is your supply chain risk and the political risk and of, you know, not mitigating or, but that's more the adaptation thing, is your supply chain, where is the risk for different parts of your business brought about by climate change? And then I find if it's a risk management, which is a lot of it, or if it's a possibility of, pardon the way I'm putting this, new opportunities and new for new services, new income, and new product lines. When I am going through these things, whether it's risk management or that, they ask me about the science because they're business people and they need, so then they need to know, start learning. They realize, oh, well, I have to learn the science because what I explain to them is, you know your business better than anybody, that so you and your staff have to get up on the science involved here because you have to use that creatively for risk management or product and service development. And anyway, that's the approach I take in my little bailiwick. And it's okay so far. You know, it's a conservative place, and I haven't been burned at the stake yet. So,
Do you have any examples of local businesses that have or that have taken this to heart and actually made changes in their business as a result?
Yeah. One is an agribusiness corporation that's actually an international corporation. And they have a number of different product lines. And one of the things they've done is in their hardware division, they're headquartered in my county and they're a major employer. Okay, therefore, you know, I want to keep them happy, or we all want to keep them happy. So anyway, they attended back in 2007 a series of workshops I did. The first one was Rapid Climate Change Strategy for Business. And after that, a series of discussions ensued. And they ended up latching into, like, farm energy production technology ideas. And now they're slowly, they've added their hardware division the ability to do contracting for digesters and generators, cogeneration. And what we're hoping will be going on and what we've talked about and what our extension people are working with them on is developing, taking that along with their other corporate competencies to develop, like, you know, record keeping and all that, just like they do for their other products that they have, like, this total service thing for farms. And so we're still doing, I'm still doing little trainings or bringing people in from the campus in Madison or Green Bay to do some little trainings with their management team because they're kind of exploring this because they simply see the change that's going on as about something they have to deal with, first of all, because they're in agriculture, and also as a possibility for new areas that they might be able to introduce new lines in.
So it's a matter of adjusting their current business model to address it, as well as thinking of other business opportunities that they could take advantage of.
Right, yeah, and they've also started to become interested in, like their CFO, corporate financial officer, he follows my blog I do, and he now, and like he's, you know, he's not an environmentalist or anything like that, it's just that he realizes they have thousands and thousands and thousands of customers all over the world, and he's kind of, you know, it's on his radar screen now, fresh water, increasing temperatures, yada, yada, you know. So he's interested in you know, how that's going to affect his customer base. And so I guess what I'm saying is looking at mitigation and looking at it is part of adaptation for some businesses.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned
and it probably could be. Go ahead.
You mentioned Walmart. I'm not sure everybody's aware of the leadership that Walmart's been.
They have their whole supplier index. Their sustainability index, and they have. They're kind of basically. They kind of saw the writing on the wall a number of years ago, and you know, some people say it's greenwashing, some people say it isn't. But what the part that I understand of it is real is they have a supply chain initiative, and right now it's voluntary. But anybody who's a supplier to Walmart just never really believes it's voluntary because it isn't. but I'm sorry, I'm digressing. Basically, they want to green their supply chain, and they have a questionnaire. And the first four of the 15 questions that suppliers are more and more of their suppliers because they're working down the size thing now have to deal with. The first four are have to do with climate change. You know, like are you counting and tracking your greenhouse gas emissions, and do you participate in the Carbon Disclosure Project and all this stuff. And that's working its way down the supply chain. To give you an example of how it's working its way down, I was teaching a leadership class as a guest teacher in an adjoining county one morning, and the exercise was on, I picked a business in their county that I knew existed with a large employer, and the hands-on scenario after my presentation was they get a call from Walmart, and they were a cookie reprocessing or rebranding manufacturer, I think they're called. Anyway, and the first instance, and like not so much how do you respond to it, but how do you get your head around what questions do you have to ask of yourself to be able to start looking at this, because your customer has asked you to essentially answer the CDP questionnaire, the Carbon Disclosure Project. And what was really funny is one of the women in the class says, "Oh my God," out loud, and I said, "What?" And she says, "My boss put something just like this on my desk yesterday. Walmart's one of our biggest customers." And, you know, so, I mean, that people get interested in the science quick then, because they have to do the science to satisfy the customer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I'm just saying that's one little approach. I mean, if anybody's doing education and with businesses. But everything has to do with return on investment. I like to call it economic socially obligate boundary conditions.
When you were talking about businesses, this is Dan Barstow. I also noted the incredible power of the voice of the insurance industry when the whole blow up happened with the Heartland Institute and that ridiculous billboard. Business said, "No, we don't want anything to do with this. We're out of your entire organization if you're going to do that kind of false messaging."
Yeah, there is that, and there's a lot of companies starting to drop off, you know, in the political sense from the National Chamber of Commerce, for instance, because of the games they've been playing. But in my kind of localized or regional work here in Wisconsin, generally what I find is if there's an economic aspect to it that is of benefit, either saving money or making money for the people I'm working with, that's first and foremost, and whether it's adaptation or mitigation. And then the interest in the science follows quickly upon their conceptualization of something, because they need to understand the science, whether it's dealing with somebody in a supply chain that's in a drought area, or a new opportunity for a bio-based thing instead of a fossil-based thing. The science is interesting because that's how they have to tool their minds to be able to recognize as in ongoing time. Over the next century or two, essentially, the risks and opportunities they can deal with. But the money comes first.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry to go on so long about it.
Oh, no, that's fine.
Very,
thank you. It's an interesting perspective. I think one of the things that we struggle with is how to address these various kinds of communities. And, you know, they each have their own important hook into what it is that's important to them for which we need to think about how to address.
Yeah.
Well, I think
that's very true.
The best efforts are going to remain local because, you know, you really, it needs to be relevant. And I think we all agree that not having a local message would be terribly delinquent. But it's back to what are the big messages and who is the messenger. And even if what we do here is come up with some talking points so I can stand up and read five things out or say five things out that everybody is saying and grounding it so they become the talking points of climate science, that would be fine too. But I do think the individual effort is the answer in the long term. I mean, I do think everybody on this network and the work we're doing and the tentacles we're doing is the way we're going to get change. I was more interested in an umbrella.
Yeah, Caroline, I definitely agree that the local is important, but to piggyback on what Jay was saying, part of the potential or sort of the teachable moment that these global efforts to sort of monitor the supply chain so that down the line you can, you know, scan the barcode on your iPhone and see not just the carbon footprint, but the toxic waste footprint, the social footprint, you know, all these things that are currently invisible. And that's enormously, you know, transformative, at least potentially.
It's profound.
Some people are calling it sort of radical transparency where, you know, we can actually, for the first time, be able to see and make our choices about what we buy based on the footprint, the story of the stuff that we're buying, you know.
Well, it's profound and empowering, but you also have to be very mindful of the fact that the spin agents are going to come with their combative way of changing and making those numbers less relevant and less. I mean, this is a game to some people in the economic realm of climate denial. And so I think the more tools that we can give society, like you just mentioned, and the speaker before, are pretty incredible and very empowering. But I still say I'm tired of people going, why don't I know this? And that this is the wild consensus that exists by the most credible bodies of science in the nation and in the world. And that's, I'm getting there. I mean, I'm carving my own message at this point. But that's, I think, what the four of the six Americas would help fire them up in the right ways for adaptation and or mitigation and or moving on to the next level and using these tools that we create to find out the footprints of some of these companies we service. I mean, look at this social media. My daughters are now Chick-fil-A fiends. I mean, they have broken up friendships over Chick-fil-A, you know, and I think that the ability to expose quickly some of the carbon footprints and protocols of some of these big companies is awesome. I would say all of this is good. I think this particular conversation is so healthy that I would encourage us having some of these during the year too, Tamara, because I learned so much stuff in the last 20 minutes that it's good to know it's happening and it's coming.
Well, I suggest everybody support the ELO bill with zero footprint then, because that's what Zero Footprint's doing. That's why they won the Department of Energy ZAP Award.
Yeah, this is Jay again regarding product labeling. Of course, the Europeans or the EU is pushing, and I know England, there's a grocery store chain that's doing it already, of the carbon intensity of do a life cycle analysis on the product, and there's a simple number and label on the product at the grocery store for the consumer. And, of course, doing something like that in the American political system could take, you know, the better part of a century probably. But what's interesting is that one of the things, getting back just for a moment to Walmart again, that supply chain initiative they have contracted with two universities. One of them is the University of Arkansas. And they are developing for themselves, and that, of course, would impact everybody, their own carbon intensity labeling schema, you know, for their products. And so that'll be interesting, you know, to see what they come up with on that. Just one other brief comment. One of the things when I'm talking to other extension educators at a workshop about talking about climate change or teaching about it, that I always, you know, apart from the money being, you know, even on individuals, not just businesses' minds, another curious thing I came across a couple of years ago is a concept called hyperbolic discounting. And in behavioral economics, a hyperbolic discounting is, if you Google it, and Wikipedia's actually got a pretty good article on it, but essentially it's the formal explanation of something we all know, that the farther away a benefit is, the less serious people consider it, okay? Mm-hmm. And basically that's called, in behavioral economics, called hyperbolic discounting, and literally it is a formula for it is that the farther away the benefit from is for a current act, the less important it will be.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the benefit is inversely proportional. Perceived benefit is inversely proportional to the length of time the benefit takes place in the future. And recently some researchers working with behavioral economics and, you know, the kind of Darwinian thing that's going on in economics, some aspects of economics now, they actually have a formula for it, and it appears, there's some research out there, it appears to be stuck in the wetware, which is interesting because on an ancestral landscape, low population, plenty of space, all that, yada, 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 that might have some benefit, you know. But it might be just like our inability to deal with long-term decision-making, it mm-hmm. seems, at times. That might be another complicating factor. And I just wanted to throw that in there. That I'm finding, at least in my research, that there may very well be biological origin things that we have to overcome. Now, I'm not saying since they're biological, that's okay. I'm just saying it underlies the nature of the problem, maybe some.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's quite interesting.
Yeah, I kind of freaked when I read it, but the first time.
You know what I wonder, though, is, like, you remember when smoking made turn the corner? The public, you know, we went from, you can't infringe on my rights to smoke where I want to smoke, to, I mean, somebody lights up anywhere in sight, we all look at them like they're nuts. So societally, how we made that switch and got people away, you know, somebody threw that argument to me about how we rallied with, you know, the HIV virus and these big epic moments in life when we understand something. And there were a lot of people at arm's length on HIV. I'll never get that. I'm not homosexual. I don't know any. And there are a lot of people who felt that way about smoking, you know. But they turned. And so let's hope it's not a century for America to turn. But I do, you know, I do think the turn has to come, and or everybody here is sort of pushing a little bit to get us reoriented. I don't know. What is this called? Hyperbolic what?
Hyperbolic discounting.
Discounting. Okay. That's very
yeah.
interesting, yes.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned the smoking thing, and unfortunately there's a number, at least of the ones that were younger in the 80s and 90s, of the folks that led worked for the tobacco companies on that issue, you know, spinning
yeah.
it on secondhand smoke, are literally a number of them are now involved in the denial factory think tanks on climate change.
I did not know that.
That surprised me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's nice to see they're still making a living and didn't have to change what they do that much, you know.
A criminal mind is a criminal mind, you know. Very interesting.
I'm an ex-lawyer. I just think, oh, everybody needs a job.
Okay, well, we are at the top of the hour. I invite everybody to, if you wish to add comments either to the listserv or to the Google Docs, to do that. And we can continue to think, we can have these, continue to have these kind of discussions through the year. If we want to actually come up with some joint messaging that we can share, maybe we can do that through the Google Docs or the email exchange, but we can see how many people are interested in pursuing that further also.
Great. Thank you for poking me.
Okay. Well, thanks everybody for calling in. We will talk again next week.
Excellent. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.